And Prost, Bier.
Ja. Prost. Prost.
Der Marsch hier, Humble Bundle. Leute.
Tomorrow Corporation.
Welcome, international audience. You're listening to Biertaucher Podcast, issue 226. Today, we have here Horst,
Derek,
Gregor,
Dennis,
Bernd,
and Thomas.
Boah, Riesenrunde.
And we thank our sponsor.
Ah, ja, genau. YorkConnect.com. Ach ja.
If you're an international customer looking for internet agency in Austria, head over to WooConnect.com.
From which city are we recording?
We're recording here live from Vienna, from the best Kurdish local in a restaurant in Vienna, from the Zypresse, Westbahnstraße 35A. Westbahnstraße
35.
Yeah.
Hey,
Westbahn
Street.
Yeah, Westbahn Street. Okay. Good.
West Train Street.
Yeah. This is the English issue of this podcast. Normally we speak German only, but today we have a star guest, Derek Breen, directly imported from United States, and so this issue is in English language.
You.
Okay.
Okay. Let's start.
Good. We begin with just that everyone says what he wants to speak about, and then we speak about it. Okay? Mm-hmm. Let's just make a round. I begin. I want to report that I today was in an Austrian school in Vienna and did a two-hour Scratch workshop.
Oh.
And yeah, that was it.
And I spent the day at MetaLab meeting with some really cool local people who've developed a robot for children that they're crowdsourcing on Kickstarter.
I hope you also speak about your travel to South Africa.
Oh yeah, I'm happy to speak about South Africa.
And you was doing a Scratch workshop on Sunday with Turtle Stitch with Andrea Meyer.
With you?
Yeah, you could, yeah. We could both talk about
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, my topics. I wanted to see a film.
You wanted to see a film.
One good one. And it's the next step of podcasting. Not the films I saw, the films I wanted to see.
Yeah.
The one is The Martian and the other one is The Maze. The one I suppose is very, very good, and the other one not so good, but I have seen the first part, so let's see. And I have bought a Humble Bundle adventures and Nordic games, so my favorite genre of games.
I will talk a little bit about Tomorrow Corporation, and I can do it now. Look at the homepage of Tomorrow Corporation in the next day and buy it the next game. And that's all. And the second thing is Beginner's Guide. Buy it. That's all. And für die nicht-internationalen Gäste, ich war im Kino.
Dennis was in the cinema.
Und habe mir erst wieder da angeschaut.
But he have seen some German film.
Very exact translation. Okay. I have no specific topic.
I actually also don't have a topic, but Horst said we might want to talk a bit about 3D programming in Python.
Okay, and I can add that I bought and played today Sir, You Are Being Hunted, Humble Bundle game that you can play on Linux.
Let's start.
So then I'll make it backward. Thomas, you are noted Vienna game developer, artist, game artist, and programmer. Can you talk about how is it to program 3D games, 3D graphics with Python?
Oh, that's a really broad question.
So just say that what you want to say.
Yeah. Well, this week I'm actually continuing. So I've in my free time, I'm doing some work on a little 3D project in Python. I'm using the Piglet library for that, which allows you to basically interface with OpenGL. I'm trying to go the hard route. That means like no Unity, no.
You use no game engine. You really code everything yourself.
Which is nice because then you also get like all kinds of weird artifacts on the screen and weird glitches that if you would just do it in Unity, it would be like probably done in 2 hours or something like that if you're used to programming Unity. but that's not the fun part of it. So this week I started, and at the moment failed, doing collision detection. So right now you can walk around the landscape, and there's already like the floor or the terrain.
So and you have a 3D area where you can go like in a...
And you can walk around. There is actually... You don't sink into the ground because that's kind of easy to do. So basically you just limit the y-axis. So the axis that goes up for me is the y-axis, and you don't sink into the ground. You're just limited to that. So if you fall, there's already gravity, so you can jump and there's gravity.
But if you there's just, a mountain, you walk to the mountain?
But you can climb up the mountain as steep as it gets, so there's no limitation, and you basically are a real good mountain climber, and you climb really fast because you just walk up and... It's an Austrian game, so to speak.
and is there actually a GitHub project or some...
Not yet. I plan to publish it at some point, but it's not at that stage yet. And yeah, there are also houses already, like real simple houses that look like
blocks,
basically cubes. What's the name for the stretch? If not the sides are all the same, it's a
stretched cube.
Yeah, like a
3D rectangle.
Yeah.
So you can have cubes and 3D rectangles, and that can make up houses, but you can see them, but you can still walk through them, and that's something that I want to look at next.
So actually, you can, unlike other 3D games, you can go into the houses.
Yeah, kind of, but it's...
True,
yeah.
Maybe you're a ghost.
Yeah, you can always make the gameplay description in the way that you don't have to do anything, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a really dark room, so you don't see anything, but it's full of wonderful things. It's just very, very dark. Black screen.
Blindness.
Done.
Okay.
I guess that's it. Maybe in some future podcast when I've progressed some more, we can talk a bit more about that.
Okay, thanks, Thomas. Scratch workshop. Okay, I was doing a Scratch workshop in an Austrian school. I had an appointment to do a workshop there, and I was just checking if they have a good computer equipment, which is not given in any school. And I was very surprised they had dual boot Ubuntu Linux and Windows. And on the Linux machines, the children know, they were 15 years old, they know their password, which was actually a sudo password, so I can install things. The internet was working, and I was very impressed. I said, wow, I can do a really good workshop. And then one of the girls there asked me, can you teach us game programming now? And I said, yes, I have 2 hours time. You must ask your teacher. And then they said, yes. And then I made a Scratch workshop because I had nothing specific prepared, and I don't wanted to improvise with the Linux. I wanted to do something simple. And I said, well, for a Scratch, you don't have to boot Linux. You can... stay in the Windows that most of you have booted anyway, and you just open your browser and go to the site scratch.mit.edu. And what happened? From, I think, 12 PCs, around 4 managed to do that, to go to the website. One spontaneously crashed because it was Windows. And another children made long faces and said, yes, there is no Flash player installed. And then there was some discussion what that a browser and internet. I should have done the right thing and forced the Vul class to boot Linux and use Firefox on the Linux. So my liberalism was hurting me.
What was actually need for the Flash player? Is there an online version of Scratch that runs in the Flash player?
Yes, exactly. This is the Scratch 2. This is you can play it offline. There's a version with offline, but then you need to install Adobe Air, which is even more complicated than install Flash player. And for the usual Scratch, what you just play online on the website, you just need a Flash player installed.
So Scratch 2 is actually written in Flash ActionScript or something?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the bad point about it.
Yeah. Is there any plans of, I mean, now with MScript and stuff like that, can you actually try to get it working?
I've seen somewhat working versions in HTML5 native, so I assume that's going to be the next full version release. Yeah,
and there are also similar products to Scratch, like Snap.
Yeah,
Snap. and others who run in HTML5.
So Scratch is the one with the cat, right?
Yeah.
Yes, with the cat.
So the previous Scratch 1 was a native application, or was it?
Yeah, Scratch 1.4 was created in Smalltalk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Scratch 1 you can easily download.
Yeah.
So if you have to give an offline
workshop. Are there any feature differences between 2 and 1? Or would you recommend...
Yeah, there's some pretty big differences. I mean, what's interesting is Scratch 1.4 is getting, has a resurgence because it's installed on Raspberry Pi. So if people buy Pi, then they're using the earlier version of Scratch. Scratch 2.0 is far superior for game development because in the previous version, you can't have cloning or instances. So you have to have individual sprites for every single object in the game, which is a real drag for...
So you can't do like a particle system easily.
No, it would be incredibly time consuming to do it. And also you can't do custom blocks. You can't do procedures in the old version. So, and my favorite feature in the new version and part of why they originally went with Flash is a vector graphics engine. So being able to create vector graphics within Scratch is a pretty big deal, for animation in particular. Yeah.
Also, the nice thing if you use the web version of Scratch 2 is that they continually evolve. So today I discovered a new feature I was not seeing before. It was cloud storage variables. So you can store a variable in a cloud on a server.
Yeah, that's the other thing. With the web version, can you actually save your project and load it and share it?
Yeah, it's inbuilt.
Do you have to log in or can you save to the local hard drive?
You can save to the local hard drive without logging in. Yeah.
Is there also like a community thing or where you can share it somewhere?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, really, I think the most powerful feature in the online version of Scratch is the remix button. So you click one button and you have full access to all the code and can make any changes and share
and
it back out.
Republish your changes.
Yeah. And it's been translated into over 40 languages. So now people can natively code in their own language for the first time, which is pretty huge when you think about it. It's software for kids. But until now, all programming languages, for the most part, have been in English. And there's finally a language that allows people that aren't native English speakers to express themselves digitally.
So that means that the keywords are actually translated?
Yeah, so all the blocks get translated into the native language and all the entire interface. Yeah.
So if I load an English... If I'm German-speaking and load the English program, I actually get the keywords translated to German?
Yeah.
So you don't save the localized thing, but you just have like a symbol or a keyword for that,
right.
And I just see it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, exactly.
So it's not like Visual Basic for applications in the 90s where you can program in German with German words, but it's not possible to run the scripts on an English version.
Right, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Really
yeah.
Yeah. To conclude it, I made a zombie shooter game, something that is very fun to do in an official school, because I know as an official state paid teacher, I would maybe get into troubles. And the kids were really excited for 15-year-olds. They were very brave. I had 2 hours time. They made no break. Nobody was going to the toilet. And the kids were even disciplining themselves. So if I always ask it, dramatically, oh, how much time I have left? Can we make hit points for the zombies? Ah, yes, we have 20 minutes left. I can show you this feature also. So I was trying to show a bit off and grab a lot of coding inside it. And the kid said, really, so if one kid asked too many questions or made too much fun, the other kid said, no, be quiet. We want more code. We want to use this man. Teach us more. And then there was, at the end, of course, the teacher was also impressed, which was my goal. And then the teacher said, and this nice mister now have done you this workshop, and now he want a feedback. I never say that, yes. And could you say what you think about it? And nobody was responding, because every child was busy shooting zombies with the game. And that was for me the best feedback ever. So it was very nice.
Did you two questions. One is, did the game actually have artwork? And if yes, where did you get that? Or did you create it in the workshop?
Yes, I don't wanted to use the, so Scratch has a little library of inbuilt artwork that you can use, and you can import games, or there's even a feature that you can use a camera And there's a pixel paint and a vector paint program inside. And because my time was limited and the children were 15 years old, so I wanted to focus on programming and not on drawing, I, by design, choose to make very simple graphics with a vector graphic program, because usually as soon as you show the children the inbuilt library of pictures, they are very busy choosing the most colorful butterfly, and then the Windows-based Flash players crash even more because the computer overload with moving large pixel areas around. So I just wanted simple graphics, and they were still good looking. So.
Okay. Did you upload the game so we could play?
I think it should be uploaded. I'm not sure if I shared it, but I shared a similar one in summer. So, but you just look in Scratch on the Horst Jens or Zombie Games. And, but it's basically
Zombie and you find.
Yeah, it's a bit hard actually to find something in Scratch. But I will put some tutorial on my homepage. Okay. It's made with just three sprites, so it's very cool. Three sprites and cloning, of course.
If anybody runs into that problem where they're teaching Scratch at a school where they don't want violent video games, there's a very easy solution we use at MIT. Call it paintball. So that it you're shooting paint instead of other things. And then zombies really hate red paint. So if you use red paint, it's just like killing a zombie. But, and it looks good against the green too.
I must also say I was very impressed with the students because without prompting, one student asked, could I change the graphics with pictures of kids in the school and teachers? This was very unspoken. And I said, yes, you can, but don't put my name on it. Well, also, so the conclusion is, well, if you you can hire me, or you can, if you want, go yourself in a school and make a Scratch workshop. If they have good computers, it's very fun to do. But if there's a chance, use Linux. Don't use Windows to make it easy, because it will hurt you back. So the Windows will that you allow them to use Windows will hurt you while teaching. So it will cost you valuable time where some whining kid will have to reboot
or maybe go for a Scratch 1, or is that not recommended?
Scratch 1 has not the clone-to-clone collision detection and some other things like Derek said. So you can do things with Scratch 1, but if you are used to Scratch 2, it's very better. So you have more options, especially for games.
And Scratch 1 isn't online, so it would have to be downloaded and installed, which is hard to do at schools. As a guest, I mean.
I wonder if it would be possible to get the whole Smalltalk engine of Scratch 1 to run on the Emscripten in the browser, maybe? Maybe not that efficient, but
That Snap is sort of like that. So, some of the original developers of Scratch created a version for college at Berkeley, University of California at Berkeley, and it's gotten pretty robust. You can do quite a bit with it,
Okay. I'm finished so far with it.
So do you know any future plans where the development of Scratch is heading?
Yeah. Horst and I met at a conference in Amsterdam in August, the Scratch conference. And we saw a demo of, it's called GP. So it's in a pre-alpha release right now, but GP for general purpose. And it's a block-based programming environment, and they've gone back to Smalltalk. So the entire thing is created in Smalltalk, but very powerful. And it allows kind of every level of programming, so being able to do full-blown app development for desktop and portable. So it's got a lot of potential.
And what we have seen, the very cool thing is you can program that like a child with puzzling blocks together, logic blocks, or you have a slider, and then you have text-based programming interface like you usually did as a professional, and with a slider you can just return.
And does it work in both ways? Can I write a text program and then turn that into...
And I think this is for teaching a huge, huge thing.
Does this always work?
We don't
probably,
know.
Or most of the time it should.
Yeah, they're pretty smart guys. One of the developers is in Germany, and one is in Japan, I think. So it's sort of an international team. And they're still a few years away from it being ready for a wide release, but it's pretty robust for an alpha.
So that's probably going to be the Scratch of the future,
yep.
From today's perspective.
And they think it'll be the Scratch and the Python of the future. It'll be that fusion, which is pretty exciting.
And they definitely said Python was one of their forebilder, something that they liked.
Three pictures.
German word alert. Some of their ideals, idols, yes. And they say they want to make a general purpose programming language that has the advantage of Scratch, so easy to teach, easy to use, but is not limited like Scratch, because with Scratch you basically can just make games or animations, or something that run in the browser. And they want that you can open files, that you can read files, that you can access the internet, that you can do your day-to-day stuff that you want do with computer codes.
It's hard to like cater to all the audiences, because there's Scratch is very good at being simple and easy to teach, but on the other hand, other languages like Python are easy to like do other things. I mean, it's still easy to teach, but not as easy as Scratch. On the other hand, Scratch is not as easy to open files with and like do for general processing. So
it will be a blend.
So when you said that the Smalltalk based Scratch 1 had problems with rendering vector graphics, is that fixed in GP?
I don't think they may not have plans for a vector editing environment. That hasn't been a priority. So in Snap, the Snap software doesn't have vector. It supports vector graphics, so you can import
SVG?
SWF. I'm sorry, SVG.
The Snap graphic editor is pixel based?
Yes. You can only edit pixel graphics bitmap.
But I guess if it's going to be a general purpose language, then there will be some connectivities and bindings to other languages, so you can use...
And I suspect, I would say there's a good chance, because I suspect there are some libraries for doing vector graphics. So,
Derek, you remember, will Scratch 2 successor, the GPLus, will it be open source?
I don't know. But I know that the developers are definitely pro open source, so I think there's a really good chance. And I think they're doing it independent of any institution, which bodes well for open source. But in all likelihood, there'll be a Scratch 3.0 before GP. I really think within the next 2 years, there'll be a full Scratch release, and that's likely to be HTML5 based, so that it can run on tablets and not have any of the compatibility issues.
And run on Windows then, stable.
No comment.
At least it reduces the problem of not being able to run on the Raspberry Pi, stuff like that. On the other hand, for a Raspberry Pi, you might want to have some native stuff anyway, or like...
It'll be interesting to see if anybody picks up... I think Scratch 1.4 it's either open source or being open sourced, which means it would be easy for someone to develop a sort of 1.7 release or something, like adding cloning. That's the killer feature I think that's missing for game development.
I guess at that point it will just be a marketing issue, like telling people go for 1.7 because it's better than 2.0 or it has some advantages.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe you need a new name. Scratch Pi or something like that. Raspberry Scratch.
Well,
Itchy and Scratchy.
Scratch and Sniff. There's actually someone's created Sniff as an enhancement for Scratch, which is pretty funny.
Well, I wanted to move Derek to the end of the podcast, because I fear that the others will not have time to speak. It now makes sense if he speak about his Scratch workshop. Okay. Derek, can you explain what you did in Vienna, what you did before you was in Vienna, and what you did at Sunday?
So I just spent last week in South Africa teaching Scratch workshops for students and for teachers as part of the first annual Africa Code Week. So a continent-wide initiative to try to introduce coding to kids. And I can't remember I think it's 17 countries this year. It was 17 to 20 countries in Africa
And this is called Code Week Africa?
Or? Africa Code Week. Yeah, so for the past 3 years, Europe Code Week has been a special initiative in October to get code introduced into schools. And so they decided, hey, if it works in Europe, we should try it in Africa. And they got a bunch of volunteers from all over the world, many of them employees of SAP, the big multinational software company. So they became a sponsor. What's interesting is they, rather than just giving money, they actually recruited volunteers from all over their, I can't remember how many countries they're in, but it meant that there were all of these English and French and German people speaking all different languages coming to Africa that could work in communities where those languages were helpful. And so I'd never quite heard of anything like that continent-wide before. And they even built some buses to go to more remote areas with sort of these remote computer labs. But I spent all of my time in Cape Town, which meant it was quite easy since English is the national language there. But I was able to do a lot of work with students around enabling them to explore Scratch on their own. So rather than being the token American white guy that comes in and says, ah, you should do this, it's really important, you'll make money, get out of poverty. It was really more about going and empowering them to express themselves with the technology. So really just sort of inviting them into the world of Scratch and giving them the space to mess around with it a little bit. And then with the teachers, it was about encouraging them to just be open to students trying out Scratch, using it for projects. So bringing it into the schools and really reassuring the teachers that in the U.S., very few teachers are experts in any of these technologies, but having just enough comfort to be able to allow space for them to be used by kids. So this idea of you don't have to be an expert to teach something in the 21st century, you just have to kind of be aware of it. And then after Africa, I came back here for Europe Code Week. So that just began on Saturday, and Sunday, Horst and I were part of a big workshop, big, 30 people, it felt big, where we combined,
it was in Vienna.
Yeah, here in Vienna. So,
Art University.
Yeah, combining, Scratch and robotics and also this new technology a friend of ours has developed called Turtle Stitch, that enables kids to design with blocks in the way that they do in Scratch, make complicated graphics, but then transfer those graphics to an embroidery machine and sew their own t-shirts or bags or sew patterns on fabric. So it was pretty cool. And to see the balance between, we were really showing all these different ways to use block-based programming and technology and demystifying coding.
You can see the pictures of it on the internationalopenmagazine.org. We will upload it here together with the podcast. There's really one picture, I made it, I'm very proud of it, where you see Andrea Meyer, the head of Turtle Stitch Project, explaining on a laptop some patterns, I think it was, that there's a logo graphics that were stitched with the stitching machines on textile. And a lot of girls and women crowding behind them, and everyone has a smile on their face because they have, I think in their head, this was something like, if we guys see a new computer game or something. So it was, they were figuring, that could be on my clothing. So it's really a good technique to get people who are not primary coders into coding and show the beauty of code.
Well, and even girlfriends and partners of hardcore coders are finally lured into the coding world.
It's monochrome or it's in color? More than one color?
Well, that's the fun thing. This is a logo-like graphic, so and the computer, actually a Turtle Stitch allow only one color. But if you take the time, you can make two graphics. And between printing them two, you can change the color of the stitching machine. Yeah. So you can, or you can make a thread, as a string, with who is built itself out of two different colored strings. So it's like a bit like 3D printing, just in two dimensions. Mm-hmm. So if you tinker with the machine and the material that you're printing with, you can add color effects.
but it's easier than 3D printing because you can't print a ball with a green core.
Well, it's two-dimensional, so you can't print a ball at all.
It's impossible to print in your ball the green core, and it's impossible to print the green core and around of this other material, because you can't position it in the air.
I think it only does planar. You have a planar.
Yeah. The stitching machine from Turtle Stitch only can make two dimensions.
Yes.
You're speaking now about 3D printing.
This is a better in stitching.
Yeah, you can, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's far less problematic
because
you're not melting material and. but it also has, I think, more instant gratification. Like, I did a t-shirt, and everywhere I go, people are sort of dazzled. And it was one piece of thread, but with seven different shades between green and yellow. So it actually looks like several different threads. Please, everyone should be trained.
So, if you didn't hear, for the listener, we are now seeing some really good food based. Which country is that?
This is Kurdish food, and this is a warm pre-dinner meal, so a warm starter. Yes, with lentil and warm melanzani.
So for the most authentic podcast experience, you're going to pause the podcast now, make yourself something to eat, and then you resume the listening when we return as well.
You also have to drink half a beer because every one of us has now exactly drunk 1/4 liter of beer. Yeah, so, except Thomas.
We're sorry that we don't have scratch and sniff technology for Open Magazine yet.
Not yet.
Yeah, it's coming.
Okay.
One thing I wanted to ask you about your journeys, Derek.
Yeah, sure.
I was at work and I think Horst sent me an email with a YouTube video. And it was, my food comes. Wow, beautiful. Thank you. Prost durch.
Karit, Karit.
Ah?
Bier.
Okay, but now by Derek. I think it was in Brussels, and there was a bunch of people. The first video was a bunch of people in front of the European Parliament or so.
Yeah.
And there was a dance involved in the parliament.
Yes.
So what was this about?
So I was at the EU almost by accident. I drove a friend there who's a Code Week ambassador for the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that I ended up being invited in, and before I knew it, I had become the first ambassador for the US because they'd been wanting to get somebody to come and hadn't been able to get an American to come all the way to Brussels.
Hmm.
So there I was in a t-shirt, a Code Week, EU Code Week t-shirt, and all of a sudden they're teaching us how to dance. And I have no idea what's happening. But somebody came up with this idea for having a theme song, which is called Ode to Code. And then they would teach children this robotic dance all over Europe. And they would do this dance, but then they would remix it or modify it in a way, just like they would with a scratch project, to make it more the flavor of their country. So we did it initially to show the playful side of all these ambassadors who are just volunteers at the EU. And then because I thought it was a pretty fun idea, I did a version in Africa with the African children last week, and was inspired by an Italian version that I'd seen where they started off doing it the correct way, and then they're like, no, we gotta do it like this. And they kind of spiced up the music, and I thought, we'll do it in Africa with beatboxing children singing, and it turned out pretty cool. So if people want, they can do a search on YouTube for Africa Code Week Ode to Code, or Ode to Code African Style.
Yeah, cool. We will
link it in our show notes.
Yeah.
The show notes can be found at internationalopenmagazine.org.
Yeah. And if you really want to see something strange, because that's not strange enough, There's also video of me break dancing in Africa during a coding workshop to honor the sort of bravery of the kids that were willing to get up on stage and beatbox and sing. Mm. And so I thought I would do something that would be equally risky or not risque. That would be different. But, so I tapped back into my 80s era refrigerator box dancing. Gave it a try and got a standing ovation from some African kids.
Yeah, that's called really crazy. Or what is that loud?
Yeah, well, what's great is if you're bald and 45 and from America, it's better if you do it badly. That's what I learned. Do it badly and it's far more entertaining, as if I had a choice.
Yes, it's a recommendation. It was really fun to watch in my work just before I started really to work. It was a good start into my working day. Yeah.
So will these kids, after the code week ended, will they have machines where they can actually continue developing, or?
Yeah, the schools that I went to had computer labs, and the headquarters for this was at a science museum in Cape Town, which has a dedicated computer lab. I was so moved and inspired that I'm going back for 3 months. So I agreed to go back in December and stay and work on follow through, not just for Cape Town, but for all of Africa, figuring out if we do it again next year, how do we make it something that isn't just for a week and isn't just about volunteers coming in, but really getting mentors and teachers trained to be able to continue beyond that week.
Because I think if it's just 1 week, it's nice and exciting. But if it just happens once a year, then you might not get up to speed that fast. For those kids that are really interested. I guess not everybody has to be interested and not everybody will stick to that, but at least a small percentage. And then they should have the ability to access those machines and the language and the setup.
Yeah, I totally agree. What's fun is to see some of them are continuing because they're uploading and sharing their projects on the Scratch website. And so it's a way that even for the volunteers that left, they can still have some contact with kids and teachers that they worked with, which really wouldn't have been possible almost at any other time until tools like Scratch that allow online collaboration came out. It's pretty cool. Yeah.
So now it's the dinner break. We will see you after the break.
Yeah. Well, you make beatboxing during this time, boss.
My understanding is it's the best-selling computer of all time because that one model was on sale for years and years and years. How about you? First game.
My first game was Tetris on the Game Boy.
Oh, yeah. Classic.
I'm a little bit younger than you, and so 1990, I get a Game Boy, and with Tetris, my brother, a Game Boy with Super Mario Land. Ah. And yes, and my first PC game should be, I don't know, I think... Solitaire. Yes, it must be Solitaire. Okay. And
classic.
Yeah,
classic.
Windows 3.11. Yeah.
But I had a console before the C64. You had, you could plug it onto the TV.
Yeah.
Okay. And you choose the game by switching.
Some switch.
And there was the famous game, the
Pong,
yeah. And I don't remember. I think there was 3 or 4 games on it.
Yeah,
but
they were all variations of Pong, right?
Yeah.
Like you'd call it tennis because it would be
That's right.
And hockey,
yeah.
There'd be two things. Yeah, I had that too. Yeah, ColecoVision in the U.S. Yeah, and sometimes it had a gun. You'd shoot a little dot on the television.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Horst?
Yeah, what's
it? I not remember exactly, but I know that I was a gamer long before I had a computer, and I also know that I could program BASIC before I had a computer, because I was gifted, as I was 13 or 12, I was gifted a BASIC book. And I read it from I really know it by heart, and I could write code. I remember I actually wrote code, basic code, on with pen on paper, just to, because I was so excited. Yeah, but I think one of my first games was a Saxon for the
Commodore. Yeah, Saxon,
which was actually 3D, kind
of. Yeah, it's also fake 3D.
And I loved it because I was in the Luna Park of Vienna, in the Prater. There was a card machine where you put in coins to play that. And then I said, wow, I would save so much money because I can that now play at home. And then I remember we tried to copy the audio tapes with this, we tried to copy it on a stereo thing, and it was not working. And then we, with a pen, we had these audio tapes somehow messing around also with the tapes and cutting it and fixing it.
Did you actually figure out why copying those cassettes didn't
we
work?
We were children, so
but maybe. You didn't have any.
I copied a lot of games later, but not so much on tape because then I saved for a floppy disk.
So you never figured out. That's something I should figure out for next podcast. How to copy old games with music cassettes on a stereo.
Yeah, it should have worked, but it did not work. So,
but we were young.
It could be possible that it's mono.
Yeah, this is one problem. So the first attempts I tried to get game music from the C64. It was just a half success because I had the music only on my left ear.
But that's game music, right? You actually tried to copy the data?
We wanted to copy the Saxon game, yes? Yeah. We had it on one tape that was working and we want to multiply it. So we had a lot of criminal energy with 12 years.
I never bought that game. For C64, I think we all copied it.
I could already. There was not even jobs.
Yeah, and I remember there was a shop where you could buy C64 games, but only very few. And this was called Niedermeyer. It was an electronic shop. It's not around anymore. But it's only two or three with.
For the listeners, we are all male, we are all in our 30s or 40s, and we all
have 20s.
only Thomas is 18 years old, and we all now have a look with glossy eyes, like we think about lost girlfriends.
So if you're in your 20s, can we say you came post-graphical interface, post-mouse? Like, were you born after 1984?
Yes. So my first, first computer game experience was, I guess, the NES. There was this prepackaged game where you had Super Mario Bros. 1, Tetris, and Nintendo World Cup. I think 92 or so, or it was based on the World Cup of 92. So I think Cameroon was the worst one, and I'm not sure which. So basically, the teams were ranked based on how they fared in the actual World Cup. Those games were pretty fun. And then my computer experience started with a 486 that already had a mouse. It already had a SoundBlaster 16 and a CD drive, a double speed CD drive, which was a big thing back then.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's how I got started.
Well, to move back from memory lane to present, I can report that I today bought a Humble Bundle with Bitcoins, because Bitcoins is no real money. I can spend that all on Humble Bundles. It's actually one of the few things I use the Bitcoins for. Mm-hmm. And yes, there was a Humble Bundle, and included was, "Sir, you are being hunted."
Yes.
And this is a tweet punk game, because you play in a British island, procedural generated, so randomly generated British island, where you somehow, by a time machine, or some kind of steampunk device, you are teleported there with very minimal equipment, and then you are hunted by British upper class robots who make a sport of hunting humans. And this is very cool. This is a ego shooter sneak around game like Thief. So,
thank you.
Mit den Nerven,
ja, okay. Herrlich.
Danke schön.
Bitte. Ich bitte darum. And well, it's the game.
Ja.
Ja, genau. Es werden die leeren Teller abserviert. Sie sind alle leer und es hat allen geschmeckt, so was ich mitbekommen habe.
Hm? Well, to sir, you're being hunted. The game is around the centered around the theme that you start with luck. So you lack equipment, you lack safety. You lack everything, so you get a very paranoid feeling. Mm. You must play it with headphones because you have to listen very carefully, and you have to sneak around. You always hide like a little insect in the darkness, in dark corners and woods, and then you fear the robots. And you have, even if you start with a gun, you have very limited ammunition, and then you have to loot buildings, and the buildings are far less than the game of Thomas because they're just blocks, but you cannot walk into the blocks. You just can touch with a hand, you can touch the door of the building, and then you get a loot inventory screen where you can loot more or less useful items. And as far as I understood it, while you're looting and inspecting in the inventory screen the items, the game goes on. So you can actually be shot. I was not sure if maybe it's...
Is it an online multiplayer game, or do you just play it locally against bots?
I played single player, but there was a multiplayer option in the menu, but I did not figure out how...
So in the single player game, you can actually get, I don't know, hit or shot by computer bots while you're looting a building.
Yes, well, I did not experience that. I was not being shot while looting, but I noticed that the shadows moved because the sun and night, night and day cycle, and I had the impression that the game does not pause while I'm inspecting the inventory. But for me, it's not fun. I want to have my time to inspect each thing. Yeah. Well, but the other thing was I want to go inside a house. And then see the inside of the house. I don't want to stay outside the house and have a three meter long arm and loot inside the building. It makes no sense. Yes. So, yeah. Well, but you can sneak, you can actually crouch, then you feel like an insect, so you have a very low point of view, and you have a visibility, radar-like interface.
Yeah, like a meter. That's
you're
hidden or not.
Yeah, yeah, and you see how much hidden you are. So if you're really hidden, the robots can go very close to you, and you hear them very, very cool. They make so electronic noises. They say, "Hello, is there someone?" What's going on? This might be dangerous. So they are like a mixture of British upper class hunting society and R2-D2 from Star Wars. It's cool. And you must gather artifacts to build your teleporter to go back to your real human world. And you can, as far as I understood, you can choose to battle it out with the robots and then hunt for loot them for more weapons and so, or you can just sneak around or just try to... The robots are noise sensitive, so you can try to make a distraction for them, so they heat toward the noise, and then you can try to clean passages where the robots normally patrol, so you can try to manipulate them. But it's a very claustrophobic, paranoid feel.
So survivor, stealth.
Yeah. That.
Okay.
And it's nice scenario.
This was the only game in the Humble Bundle?
No, there were a lot of games, but this was the only one I actually tested.
Yeah, yeah. I also thought about it because I like the title so much. Yeah. Yeah, even looked at what it sounds like in French. Yeah. It says, "Vous êtes chassé, monsieur."
Baguette.
Je ne parle pas français.
Gregor, you had a very fascinating topic. You wanted to go in at cinema.
I can talk a little bit about it. There's a movie in the cinemas called The Martian with Matt Damon in the main role part, and Jeff Daniels, I think, is also with it, and I am very interested in this film because there was a book That is very successful, and I heard in many podcasts about it, and they were all very enthusiastic about it. And this morning I heard an interview with Matt Damon, and he said this film is like a love letter to science and engineering, and so I'm into it. I have to watch it. And the story, plain and simple, Matt Damon plays an astronaut who is forgotten on Mars on a mission, and then he has to survive on Mars for a period of time until the rescue mission.
So it's like Kevin allein zu Hause.
It's earlier as a mixture of Kevin allein zu Hause or Robinson Crusoe on Mars, which is also an older film.
Didn't he also play in the movie that came out like 1 or 2 years ago?
Yeah, he played in this Interstellar.
Interstellar. But it does not have any relation to that.
Well, nearly the same. He's also lost on a planet.
Yeah, but I mean, like,
from the
characters or from the story, it's a totally different thing.
Yeah. I think it's more like Castaway, the Tom Hanks film, like being stuck on a desert island kind of thing, except with no food. And no
and
oxygen.
No packages and no Wilson.
Yeah, exactly. No volleyball on Mars.
You saw the first part of the film?
Well, I saw the first part, but I couldn't understand hardly any of it because I don't speak German. Which, by the way, is why this podcast episode is in English, for the one American at the table who's totally ignorant. But I thought, well, I've been spending time in Munich and Vienna. Maybe it would be great to go and see a movie in German. And I thought, well, if it's an action movie, then no big deal. Like, I'll be able to follow. And the first act, maybe the first 15, 20 minutes, I could follow pretty well. But at a certain point, it just becomes like Matt Damon doing his video diary for the day. And then Jeff Daniels at a press conference. And so, yeah, I just, at a certain point, it just became silly. Like, I took off the 3D glasses and went out and thought it was worth paying the money for the experience. And, but the film does, it's so beautifully shot. It's very realistic. And so I really do want to see it in English. And I miss Matt Damon's voice. I kind of thought maybe he would dub it in German because he speaks German in the Bourne movies. And I thought, oh, well, he can do it, right? He's Matt Damon. But it's clearly not Matt Damon.
Yeah. I guess once the actors get like their assigned dubbing actor, then they stay the same.
I was wondering about that.
Yeah, I think it's like when they're not famous yet. So for some actors, if you watch the really early movies of them, they might get some random dubber assigned, or voice actor assigned. But once they're... So, for example, Bruce Willis always has the same voice actor, so you get kind of used to the voice of Bruce... of the German voice of Bruce Willis.
except the Stirb Langsam 3... Die Hard 3, voice actor was ill.
Oh, okay, so it switched.
Yeah, sometimes
that film didn't work.
I think it happened for the voice actor of Marge Simpson that she died, and it happened for some others as well. So the voice actor or the dubber dies before the real actor, so they have to exchange it for some other actor. Mm-hmm. So that also happens. Also, it's interesting for some movies and TV series, the dubbing actually doesn't really follow the real script. And sometimes that makes things better. So there's, for example, some UK or US TV series that weren't that successful in their original country with the original voice, but due to the kind of not really close to original voice acting and just putting in some additional...
Yes, so you can find it on Wikipedia. There was a certain team in Germany that made the dubbing for the Bud Spencer movies, for example. But a good example is also there was a TV series with Tony Curtis and Roger Moore.
Yeah. In Germany, it's
there are many more jokes than in the original.
The Persuaders. Ah. It's called The Persuaders.
Ah, yeah. Persuaders is the original title.
And in German, it's Die Zwei. Mm-hmm. And like, if you watch the... So I have the DVD box, and if you watch the English one, it's just... It's kind of fun. But in German, it's just really overdone. And to the way that sometimes the lips don't move,
because in the original they didn't say anything, but in German they just overdubbed two or three jokes into the whole story.
Oh, that's incredible.
And Käfig voller Helden, that's an example. There are jokes without any connection to a relation to the English version.
Mm-hmm.
So it's totally different text they speak. Mm-hmm.
Has anyone seen the unauthorized Phantom Menace fan edit where they dub Jar Jar Binks into this nonsensical alien language just so they can use subtitles to add some meaning to that character? It's hilarious, and he doesn't sound Jamaican in the Phantom Menace one. Well, one thing I thought in The Martian, I actually thought that Jeff Daniels' voice was so good that maybe he should dub Jeff Daniels in English. Jeff Daniels can be a little annoying in certain roles.
The thing that you mentioned, that they had to change Jar Jar Binks' voice to actually subtitle him. Know of the meme with the Downfall movie?
Yeah.
Where Hitler finds out something.
Uh-huh.
So there's this movie Downfall where...
Oh, right. Yeah. I'm familiar with it. Yeah.
And they subtitle different things into that. Uh-huh. It's actually, if you're native German speaking, it's really hard. You have to turn off the voice because you listen to the actual text and you don't really you can't concentrate on the subtitles.
It was a really popular meme. Yeah.
It's
still remember.
There are some fan-made adapts like Lord of the Weed Star Trek Enterprise Perkining.
Perkining is a wohl film.
That's another movie. I don't remember the name of
There are Viennese dubbings of, I think, Alf.
Ah, okay.
And MacGyver. Which really...
Yeah, which brings me back to The Martian. I think for me it makes interesting the MacGyver thingy in it.
Yeah,
so that he has to deal with a short amount of water and have to be inventive and so on. So and it's made by Ridley Scott. So
yeah,
I'd have to say more.
Yeah. And it's also a bit like Apollo 13, where they're having to come up with all these innovations.
So.
I remember MacGyver will be verfilmed as now not it should be there are no a new film? No a really? New series
a new
a
series
really?
New series
yeah.
No do it
yes okay. With Mac Damon on Mars.
No. Mac Damon.
MacGyver.
It's not related, but I want to tell a little. Well, it's not very funny. Yes, fun. Pseudo funny story. I was witness at the election in Vienna. So you can actually go to a party and say you want to witness the election, and then you sit on this long table and the people come and you look very official. They all think you're now in the city government and salute you, and so it's very cool for to improve the social status. You think, okay, it's paper. We have no voting machines here in Vienna. This is all traditional, done 100 years before. And you go in the cabin, mm-hmm. in the where you're not seen, yes. Mm-hmm. And then you put your vote, two papers to fill out, district vote and city vote.
Yes.
And then you put the papers in the box. It's mm-hmm. it's not so complicated. Yes. And because I live normally in a bubble with people where I think they all can read and write, and so I was not aware that how many different people exist. There were actual people who did not understand the voting process. Yes. Mm. And Vienna has, Some were first-time voters, can also be immigrants who are first-time to allow to vote, but one was actually going out of the cabin,
mm-hmm.
yes, and said, do I have to also fill the name? You can write a name of a preferred candidate. And they said, no, just make the cross. And, so, mm-hmm. and then there was one woman, an educated woman, white, so middle-aged, and she got in, yes, and there were a lot of people, and she really managed to spoil two box of votings, also these boxes, these containers where the voters are done, because she got to the one table where, so the tables are organized where, in which zone of Vienna you live, yes? Mm-hmm. So she showed her identity card, she got her voting papers, she got in the cabin, filled her vote, but then there was too much people going up at the table where she was come from, so she simply got to another table, but this another table is for people from another district, so to speak, yes, from another group of houses, yes? And she put her vote inside this other box, yes? And then we were all a bit too slow to react, and then we said, hey, lady, you come from this table and put your vote in our box. Mm-hmm. And she said, yes, I think this is so organized. I go in at one side and go out at the other side. So she was from some middle management. Yeah. And this was not the case. But in fact, she ruined both boxes with votes, because now the one box had one vote too less and another box had one vote too much. And in the end, it does not change who is governing the city, yes? But still, it's the stats,
the per district.
Yes,
stats
she really managed to damage the democratic process she made the maximum damage with the minimum effort.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. But you can do nothing about it, though.
Yeah, but what can you do?
You shouldn't be able to do anything.
Whatever you do will be very bad.
You can't do anything about that. Yeah.
So what really happened was that we all were very shocked. Yes, and then the city government paid heat administrator of this table wrote down the incidents. He said he must write a protocol. Mm-hmm. And he wrote down, yes, one vote cast files. And I was not there at the counting of the votes, but what can you do? You cannot ask the lady in public, what do you voted?
When votes are in one of these boxes then?
There are around 1,000 votes in one box.
Yeah, so it doesn't count that much if one vote gets...
Yeah, of course not, but...
And I guess these incidents happen more than once per...
But I was thinking voting is so simple, you cannot ruin that, but you can actually without purpose.
It just messes up the per district stats. It doesn't really mess up the whole outcome.
Well, in this case, not because both tables were on the same district. So they had the different set of, they had the same set of candidates. Mm. So, but what really happened, you could not ask her what you voted, because that could be manipulated, and you could not open the box and try to grab the uppermost.
The thing is, you just vote for the party, right? Which is the same for all of Vienna, but then you can also give
vote for the candidates.
preferred candidates in
so two lists.
Do you actually get a different voting sheet for different districts with different candidate names, or do you put the candidate names in?
Yes, this can happen. You have different sheets for different districts, but both tables were luckily in the same district. It was just
so
different zones.
It didn't matter at all. It didn't even mess up the district stats.
It did not. Well, it depends how the voting was then at the end. How the counting was done, yes. But the correct thing, because for official result of the vote, you must say this block of houses, this sub-district had exactly this result, and she messed up.
So the boxes are not just divided by district, but also by parts.
Yeah, it's called Sprengel. It's like 5 houses, mm-hmm. 1,000 people around. Yes, and she managed to mess up two Sprengel results. Yes, mm-hmm. And another lady. So this was the worst case, and it was not intentional. But we have found no solution how to resolve that. Yeah,
it's good that you didn't find a solution.
but what you want to do. And another thing was one lady was correctly getting her identity card, putting her vote, mm-hmm. and then she was putting her voting papers inside the box. Yes?
Okay.
And we all were satisfied. And then she hauled up the envelope, where usually you put the papers in an envelope so that nobody can see it, and put the envelope in the box. And she said, what do I have to do with the envelope? And we all were facepalming. So. And then she joked, ha ha ha, now you know what I voted for.
It was a joke.
Yeah, but there the problem was less dramatic, mm-hmm. because if you count the votes, you make a big heap of all the envelopes, and then you open all the envelopes and make a big heap of the papers.
So it makes no difference because they
yes,
are all open.
If she was not the only one who did it, but you could, yeah.
But it's possible to say she voted for Green because every of these, not for FPÖ,
for the right-wing
because every FPÖ voter had forgotten to put it in the envelope.
No, also, I have no insight in
that. There's no certain protocol for this kind of exit.
No, but what I want to say is it is important that you register as witness for voting. It costs you nothing. You just have to go to one political party and say you want to go witness, and they have to give you a paper that you are official witness.
Mm-hmm.
Because if only people from a certain political direction are heading this voting committee, they can then resolve such incidents like they wish.
Mm.
And especially if you're from a small party, from as much people as possible. And voting is a democratic process. You get democratic people from all kind of intelligence, from all kind of
background. But isn't it like that in the committee there's always at least one from every party?
No, that is not the case.
Not the case in Vienna.
That is in ideally the case, but especially the smaller parties have not the manpower to have witnesses for each voting district office. So it's especially if you sympathize with a smaller party, it's important that you say yourself you want to be witness. Yeah, just I was not aware that so much can go wrong by voting, but it can.
So you the other people know you are a voter of this party because you want to witness?
Actually, not because. Only the people at the table, also the other witnesses, know, because of course we say I'm here from this and this party.
Yeah.
But even the only people who really knows it is the head of the voting table.
Mm-hmm.
So because he has to control that you have an official document that the party sent you.
Okay.
And he's not forced to disclose the origin of your party to the others. And even that does not mean that you vote this party.
So you could still go to a different party and ask for a seat there.
Even you could make mischief and go to the party you dislike most, register as a witness for them, and then make a witness in your... As
is it actually public who was witness for which party?
There should exist lists for that. Yes, I'm not sure if the...
So we can look you up somewhere in the voting results.
Maybe, yes.
So it's possible to... to view the vote counting?
Yes, I made that several times. It's not difficult. Actually helped with that.
Ah, okay. Also, if you are not part of a party?
Yeah, I'm not part of any party,
okay.
Yes. I just, the only thing is if you want to be official witness, on this table and help at the counting, yes, you must be accepted by at least one party. So you go to one party of your preference or any party who seeks a member, and you get an Wahleintrittsschein, a paper document that say we want this man with this name or these people with this name to be witness for us at this party.
Okay.
That's the only restriction, but it's a thing of 5 minutes. It costs you one telephone call and they send you the papers.
You weren't a witness of a party. You was a witness...
I was witness for the Green Party.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, I was.
It's possible to be a witness without a party.
Well, one of the party has to accept you. Has to give you the document that you are an official witness.
Ah, okay.
That must not be the party you are a member of or that you vote for.
Because I would.
You want witness?
No, I want to. Ich spreche mal auf Deutsch. Er ist gerade weg.
Our English listeners, please fast forward 5 minutes and you will get back to the English content.
Ich würde einfach nur mal gern zuschauen.
Yeah,
ohne dass ich so einen Schein brauche.
So then he said he want to just observe a voting without having a special document.
Okay.
Well, you could ask to do that, but the official reaction, at least in Vienna, would be that they refuse that. Uh-huh. That they say no to sit here on this table, also on the witnessing. You have to need a document from a registered political party that they officially sent you. I think this is a bit of security mechanism that not any kind of hooligan can go in and intimidate the
counter. Ah, okay, yes.
Because, well,
you mean I'm a hooligan?
No, that not. But I think it's okay.
Yeah. Do you actually have to be Austrian or do you have to be Viennese to do that?
No, I think the witness, you only need to have an identity card, and you have this card that one of the parties wanted to you to be the witness for them.
And is it hard to get a spot there, or is it just...
No, it's extremely simply because all the...
I mean, are they
too few manpower.
Okay, so they're always looking for people.
They're always looking for, and especially if you, and one of the benefits, just to be, say an example, the last elections I was coming very late to the election, and then helped at the counting. But this time I had only time in, so I had the workshop with Derek, so I was only there for some hours before noon. And just sit there and helped, yes? Helped, well, basically just sit there and smile to the people and like, explain them, come here, yes, and wait a bit, and we have much to do. And the fun thing is, where I profit enormous, I met one guy who was a former work colleague of mine, and I've seen him at Game City 1 weekend before, but we, and then I said, what? You actually be neighbors now? You reside in my area, two houses away? And he said, yes, since 2 years. And none of us, even if we have seen us several times, none of us had the idea to check that some of us had changed the location and we are now neighbors. And this alone is very valuable. Mm-hmm. And to meet neighbors and other people who you don't see very often. Mm-hmm. That's fun. And that everyone was thinking that I'm now somehow connected to the city government because I was sitting at the table. Everyone was very,
the most respectful.
Official Horst business.
Official Horst business. And everyone was coming to me first and not to the official clerk, because I was more friendly.
Kiss my ring.
Kiss my ring. Yeah, you're allowed to vote. Next year I will say, no. Go back.
Well, especially if you recognize that woman, you'll be like,
No,
you shouldn't vote.
No, you should not vote. Yeah. You should.
You won't vote.
Just go register yourself for voting business. It's not big fun. Well, the biggest fun was, beside me was an old man, actually not a priest, but how you say, a volunteer, not monk, but a volunteer, Catholic, pseudo-priest, how you call them, a Laienbruder.
Uh-huh.
Who is in a Catholic organization?
Like a deacon or something.
A deacon, yeah.
A rookie brother.
Something. And he gifted me a little Maria statue or so, and a sweet. Okay. Ah. Yeah. And next to him was an old lady, and she brought a box, a plastic box with... It was mushroom-shaped chocolate cookies or something. Yeah, so little mushrooms, but made out of chocolate. And she could not get that open. It was a plastic container, and then she was an old lady, so she cried, and then she said, I could not get it open, I could not get it open. Mm-hmm. Well, and the other people were busy with their lists and checking the lists, and finally, she tried it and made rich, and all these mushrooms were flying around. Wow. And then we collecting these mushrooms. Well, if you're easy to entertain, it's enough fun there. Yeah. Yeah, that's all my voting witness adventures.
Yeah.
We out of topics? Thomas?
Any more Scratch topics? There's the recording that's coming up, Robo Wunderkind.
Robo Wunderkind, yes. Yeah. That's what you hear now, if we have nothing more to say.
Later.
We interviewed Miss Anna from Robo Wunderkind.
Yeah.
This is a startup who make a very cool robot for 5-year-old children, and the robot you can program visual
programming. Yeah, it's a whole kit. So it comes with all different parts and sensors, and even a 5 or 6-year-old can put it together and program it in different ways. And what I like about it is that it's progressive. So it starts with a very simple, colorful programming language app on a tablet, and then they can gradually start using Scratch. And then eventually the plan is they can even do full-blown Python coding for these robots and build basic machines and things on them.
And the robot is made out of little cubes that you can put together as you see fit. So enjoy the interview. It's linked, and we will also link to their Kickstarter page.
It's a Vienna-based company.
And the Kickstarter is still open, right? It's still running?
Yeah.
Will it be running when this podcast is published?
I think the podcast will be published tomorrow. Of October.
Okay. So if we manage to publish that, or if Horseman, or who's the
publisher? Okay. I know what I have to do today. Okay.
I would have a small topic. Before the podcast, we talked a bit about like how important it is to get immediate feedback and how the time between programming something, actually seeing the result, affects the way you work. How do you think about what's the state of the art, especially in Scratch, about how you can make that period between programming something and seeing the result as small as possible? And are there still ways to improve that even more from the state of the art?
Instant gratification.
Yeah, I think there's tons of room to improve it. But what's so incredible is to see a child take a program, run it, whether it's a game or an animation, and be changing aspects of the program and automatically see it happening. Mm-hmm. So in a program like Scratch, where you can't really, it's very hard to crash. There are no bugs aren't really, because it's blocks. But it really makes it easy for children to understand by making a change and seeing instantaneous results. And you can even test out blocks before you've added them to a script, which is a pretty powerful thing, being able to click a block or a section of a block. So when I was young, we couldn't run a section of a program. But in Scratch, you can divide your program into all these pieces and just click on part of it, and it automatically runs, which is pretty cool. Mm-hmm.
Can I actually do stuff like reverse debugging or like do reverse?
Not
do you think that would be helpful for the kids?
Yeah, I think it would. And a lot of people are arguing that Scratch has removed some of what's useful in debugging. So people are looking at ways to introduce more debugging in future versions. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So for the input right now, Scratch is mostly dragging stuff, maybe text input as well?
Yeah, dragging, and then you can change, you can type in text or numeric values inside blocks.
Yeah. So do you think there's any, would it be easier to somehow input these not via the keyboard or via the mouse, but some different? Would there still be some advantage, or would it just be?
Yeah, well, right now, I know people at MIT that have created, they call it type blocking. So it means instead of dragging each block, when you're doing a lot of programming in Scratch or any block-based programming, the bottleneck is you have to go to each individual category to get to where the blocks are, which is a big disadvantage over typing code. So someone thought, well, what if we could type and the blocks would just appear? So
like a text filter or
something. Yeah, exactly. And so you would type if, and an if block would pop up, and you could tab into the next field and type greater than. And then you can very quickly do it. And it gets back to this idea of GP, where in GP you can be typing or dragging, whichever is more convenient for what you're doing. And maybe you start off at a really rudimentary dragging blocks together, and then gradually getting more and more confident until it's kind of pure code. But there are also big advantages to block-based programming when you are troubleshooting as a teacher. You can really see very quickly how things work with color and shape and position.
Yeah. And I guess for that it's also important to input values not just by text but also by... I mean, that's something that I experience when I do some graphics programming. You just enter some value like it's 0.2 or something, if it's something between 0 and 1.
Yeah.
And then you try it and you figure out, okay, it should be a bit more. And then you will go with...
especially if it's compiled language, you got to go with 0.3, but that's too much. So you and if you just have some way of just having a slider or something,
well,
or
it's funny you say that. I was about to say Scratch does, when you create a variable, by default it displays on the stage. If you double click that display, it goes to a slider. So you could just double click on a variable at any time that's being displayed and adjust it all in real time, get it just to the right value, and then set that value in your block. Yep. And then you double click it a third time and it goes back to being just a display box. Or you, there's a checkbox to hide and show variables. So it works pretty well.
Yeah, I think that's very important, especially for graphics programming and stuff like that, where you know that it ends up, or you don't know that it ends up at 0.23784 or something like that. But visually, or just looking at that, you can kind of easily tweak it, just seeing the result and then getting that instant feedback.
Yeah, and for animation, it's really helpful when you're working out timing, and also because kids can compose music with Scratch, they can try out different values for the tempo, and you could even use a variable to adjust all those tempos or all those notes and do it with one slider. It's pretty cool.
What does it use for creating the music or for synthesizing the music?
It's using, Flash has a built-in MIDI set that's fairly limited. And that's one thing. Scratch 1.4 has somewhat more sophisticated music making capabilities than 2.0 because of the limitations of Flash.
So Scratch 2 just, puts the, all the MIDI commands to the system, and the system does whatever MIDI renderer you have?
No, it's not true MIDI. So you can't use, if you have a sound card with its own MIDI sound library, you can't use that with Scratch. It's totally self-contained. Music is sort of a blind spot. It's not a high priority for most of the people at MIT, but there are a few really passionate people that have worked on Scratch. Mm. And typically, if you get to know them, you can try out their version of Scratch where they have tons of music synthesis. And now, as of August, if you go to Scratch X, so it's just scratchx.org, there's a parallel version of Scratch with all these third-party extensions that you can try out. So you can use different controllers like Elite Motion Controller to let you do 3D motion control. And a friend of mine has developed a full-blown synthesizer plugin where you can really do like we did on the Commodore 64 with Attack, Decay, Sustain, and Release, and you can create your own sounds and stuff. It's pretty cool.
Sounds good.
Yeah. And it's anybody can develop their own Scratch extensions just using JavaScript.
For the 2.0 version, or
The 2.0 version.
For the 1.0 version, is there also, or for 1.x,
it didn't have an open architecture for extensions.
So you have to write in Smalltalk or somehow make Smalltalk interact with
the app. Or what most people will do is, because Snap is a parallel version that is open source, you can modify Snap any way that you want. So for instance, Turtle Stitch, that our friend Andrea works with here in Vienna, they took Snap and modified it to work with these embroidery machines.
Yep, cool. So maybe somebody, Horst can program a new intro sound for the podcast.
Yeah.
I'm no sound guy, but if you look at Scratch IMS 2015, at the website of the conference, Scratch IMS conference in Amsterdam, there was a talk about extending Scratch. It was from an Italian guy, and he made it very clear how to extend Scratch with your own things, and it's also language agnostic, so you can do it in Python or whatever language you want, because basically, it's, if I remember correctly, it's XML files.
Huh.
Maybe I confuse, my memory is not so exact, but it will be linked in the show notes.
Well, people were really excited about being able to incorporate real-time data from the web in your Scratch projects. Mm-hmm. And using things like the voice, text to voice, any kind of web APIs.
there are web APIs for MIDI too.
Yeah.
I tried to use it 2 years ago, and it didn't work. And then I wrote a process and used WebSockets to communicate the browser with old a synthesizer from the 80s.
Oh.
And a controller, so a keyboard, and I developed a game. This is more complicated than a keyboard and a synthesizer, but this were important parts of the game. And it's not possible to play it in the internet because you need this small server. And some days ago, I read that web MIDI is possible to use in Chrome.
Ah.
So this is very fun. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it actually interfaces with any MIDI devices, be it
yeah.
USB or whatever you have there yeah. on your local device.
Any MIDI device. And this is a good thing. I will try to rewrote the library I used to communicate with the devices to use WebMIDI.
Oh.
And for music, I know another language, PD, Pure Data. This is especially for music and sounds. It's based on blocks too, but there are connections between the blocks, and it's not so easy like Scratch, but for music it's better.
Yeah, I've read a bit about it too.
Yeah,
it uses like wires, like
yeah.
nodes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which is really intuitive access to this kind of theme of music, because you have these blocks like machines,
yeah.
and you can draw the lines, and so you have an effect machine, mm-hmm. and you have a sound machine, and you connect it. I never used PD, but I used a similar program named Bus Machines,
mm-hmm.
and it was very interesting, and you can accomplish really fast something good with these programs. But you have to work into it, because in the machines you have to type in.
It's easy to program a synthesizer, but it's really hard to program a counter. That's a little complicated, but it's possible.
So for doing arpeggios and stuff.
Yeah.
I
programmed some patches, and then I saw that for a counter you can use messages. It's a little bit easier, and it's better for music, but not so easy for children.
And with Scratch, one of the big limitations is that you can't. It's not easy to turn sounds on and off in a quick way.
Mm-hmm.
So it means you're really just playing as, it's almost more like samples versus doing true MIDI or synthesis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I want to try that now. I want to try it right now. I have my laptop in my bag.
I'm out of topics.
Yeah, no.
Look on the show notes.
Ich habe noch ein deutsches Thema.
Yes, I will translate.
Yeah. I don't know if it's interesting for not German speaking persons, because I talk about he's back. Er ist wieder da.
So viel.
It's a movie.
Okay.
Also es handelt sich dabei um einen Film über Hitler, Adolf Hitler.
Dennis talks about a film called He's Back about Adolf Hitler.
Und Adolf Hitler wacht ganz plötzlich 2014 in Berlin in einem Wohngebiet auf.
The story is that Adolf Hitler somehow awakens 2014 in Berlin.
Und er wird dabei entdeckt von jemandem, der findet, dass er so ein ganz guter Darsteller eines Hitler-Parodisten ist.
He is discovered by an agent who thinks this guy is cool to be a player in Hitler double. Derek is vomiting. Sorry. Okay, laughing.
Okay. Und jeder denkt, dass er eigentlich nur ein Comedian ist und er tritt sogar im Fernsehen auf.
So, and this Hitler makes a career as a Hitler double in TV and get popular. And everyone's thinking he's just a Hitler imitation guy, an actor.
Und dieser Film ist eine Mischung aus Dokumentation, Mockumentary und Komödie.
Ah, it's a mix of documentary and comedy.
Das ist besonders lustig, weil bestimmte Dinge sind nicht gestellt, sondern wirklich aufgezeichnet worden mit echten Menschen, die auf ihn reagieren.
And some of those film snippets are real-life interaction of a non-aware audience with this actor. So it's a documentary how people react to such an actor.
You should have watched that one instead of The Martian.
Yeah, yeah. I could have followed this one.
Und jetzt, um Horst zu ärgern, kommt ein Wort, damit, das er nicht ins Englische übersetzen kann. Donau Dampfschiff Agenturs Kapitänskajüten Fensterscheibensprung.
And now Dennis is challenging me with my translation skills, but I can do it. He was referring a long German word, which in English does not exist because you cannot glue together words, so I must make a sentence out of it. But he was talking about a ship on the Danube who had a window, and the window had a break. The window was not
open. Du hast the window was not vergessen.
And there was some agency.
Window breaking agency on the Danube.
Yes, something like that.
Window breaking agency.
But then it's about the film.
Okay.
Back to the movie.
Back to the movie. Ja, so gibt es Szenen, in denen Leute mit diesem vermeintlichen Adolf Hitler Selfies machen, inklusive Hitlergruß.
Oh Gott, and in this film people make with this believed to be fake Hitler make selfies and showing the Hitler greeting with the right arm. Oh Gott.
That was the only part I understood, by the way, what he said. Hitler selfies.
Yeah. for non German speaking audience, actually showing a Hitler greeting out of context, also in the street, not in a theater performance or something.
No,
is illegal.
Yeah.
Yep. You can get fined for that.
In Österreich heißt das Wiederbetätigung.
Yeah. Yeah.
In Deutschland ist es nicht ganz so tragisch wie in Österreich, weil das fällt zwar unter Wiederbetätigung, aber da es sozusagen nicht ernst gemeint ist, ist es okay.
In a satiric way, it's...
Yeah, so he say in Austria the laws are even harsher than in German for doing that. And you have already seen that film?
Or? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and you liked yesterday. The film?
And
you liked it, it was in the cinema?
Yes, it's... Okay. Also der Film ist wirklich grandios, super gespielt und sehr empfehlenswert.
Dennis really digs this film.
And there really is a parallel to The Martian because this film...
It's the same actor that dubbed Matt Damon.
No. But before this film, this is based always on a very popular novel that was written a few years ago. And was very well accepted by the audience.
Interesting. It's really funny and it's really good, acted by the actors and the other people.
You think it would appeal to a non-German audience also? The film would also be interesting for a non-German audience
if it's German humor.
You have to know Germany and the situation to really get the fun.
I think it's possible that English people can genießen,
enjoy
the movie because it's a little bit, but only a little bit like Sacha Baron Cohen.
Ghost Niece.
Ghost
Niece.
No. Don't listen to Thomas.
It also makes me think, what was the one that just caused a stir last December with, No, the one where they go to North Korea.
There's also the one like in the back dark side of the moon.
Which I didn't see any of those, but apparently that's lots of movies that talk about that kind of topic these days.
Yeah.
But you will never see this movie in America because they would reproduce it, so they have
I think they
avoid the dubbing.
So do you actually like those movies, like German movies, if they actually are exported there, do you just subtitle it?
You tell us those, yes. All, in the last podcast we already talked
about.
Yeah,
they would only be subtitled. I've never seen a German film dubbed. And almost never would a German film be in a movie theater. So only, it would have to be like,
student festival or something.
Yeah, well, it needs to be, there are only two or three directors that it would be, like Wim Wenders. Particularly his documentaries. Documentaries will make it into the U.S., but not so much dramatic films. And Herzog, Werner Herzog, that kind of stuff will.
Yeah.
So it's just those sort of celebrity foreign directors, mm-hmm. but very rare. Yeah. And there's only a few directors in each country. Same with France, only a few directors, like Léos Carax maybe would be in, like Holy Rollers was the last film of his that made it mainstream in the U.S., but they make no money, and that they'd only be in a major city. So if you don't live in New York, Chicago, L.A., San Francisco, you never even hear of these films.
Which is so sad, because in past times there was a really vital cooperation between Europe film and America film. There were American actors here, European actors. I remind Romy Schneider, who acted on very many films, but better the Donald Sutherland, who filmed with Federico Fellini, and so on, and this, well, fantastic movies.
Yeah, Nicholson and Antonioni and the directors would also go back and forth. They could do English language and then go back to their native language, and we don't really have that now.
Yeah, this is very, it should be supported. So.
Yeah.
And we should, I think we might have mentioned it last time, or maybe it was after the podcast, but obviously you should watch Hercules in New York, where they actually dubbed Arnold Schwarzenegger into English.
Oh, Schwarzenegger.
Because his English wasn't so good back then.
At least here you can buy a DVD where you get three audio tracks, one where he has his original English language, which kind of sounds fun. Then he dubbed in English and everything dubbed into German.
Yeah. So they even don't let him speak his own German voice?
No. I'm not sure. Do they dub him?
German, the early movies were dubbed, not dubbed, but
he speaks his German.
But the current, it's impossible. Nobody can understand him in German
anymore. Did he do it in the beginning?
Did he
dub himself in the beginning?
I remember that Hercules was dubbed, not dubbed in English and not dubbed in German. So it's dubbed by himself.
Okay.
But it's low-budget movies. So
I didn't know that he did a Hercules, because Lou Ferrigno is also in a famous low-budget Hercules film. And, of course, they were together in what was the documentary that kind of launched both of their careers. I can't remember what it was now, but there's a documentary about their bodybuilding competition.
Pumping Iron.
Pumping Iron, yeah.
Yeah.
Basic.
Which is good. So they could have had dueling Hercules too.
Yeah, like,
if you're into such trashy face of Schwarzenegger, I can also not recommend, but I can say there exists a film named Cactus Jack. It's a western with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Kirk Douglas.
Oh, yes.
I thought you were going to say
Willem.
I thought you were going to say Kirk Cameron.
I could just, I would pay to see a Western with Kirk Cameron and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah.
Growing pains in the Terminator.
So the good and the bad actor.
Yeah,
which is which?
Yeah. This movie, it's, watch it. Or not.
Ooh. Out of topics?
Yes. I think,
Are we already at high score time-wise?
Absolutely. For our second English podcast, we now reached 1 hour and something, 2 minutes.
Is that the longest Peter podcast that we had so far?
No, no. And we still have the, seven minutes of interview.
If you want to have topics, I have some topics.
Okay, it was wonderful. Well, enjoy the interview with Anna about Robo Wunderkind. Yeah. And if you prefer us in the German language, head over to biertaucher.at. And if you enjoy
the clapping of this podcast
by Arnold Schwarzenegger,
if you enjoy us with our strong English accents speaking English, head over to internationalopenmagazine.org, where you will soon find our
magazine. Is it actually possible to register such a long domain name?
Yeah, I already did.
Okay. CEUs like me.
So you also.
Also, I found Open Mag is available, so we'll have a shorter one too.
But now you can
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
11 October 2015, I'm speaking with Anna from Project Wunderkind.
Robo Wunderkind.
Robo Wunderkind.
Hello, Anna.
Hi, Horst.
Anna, can you tell me about yourself, about the group of people you are and what your project is?
Okay, so we are three co-founders, and like we've been working on this project since 2 years. So we set off on a mission to create a robot which any child can build and program. And like we came up with the idea that we want building robots to be as simple as playing with Lego bricks. So what we developed, it's bricks with electronics inside, and by snapping these bricks together, kids build a robot, which they can later on program in an app on smartphone or tablets.
And so stamping the bricks together, I don't need wire and glue or something.
Exactly.
Like
yeah.
Lego sticks, Lego bricks.
Yeah, so it's just like normal mechanical connection, and yeah, that's what something we put a lot of effort into it to eliminate wires, because it's something which is scares people a bit, and still like you have like just simple bricks, but these are like really sophisticated elements because they have a lot of like electronic components, and like it's also Lego compatible, so kids build a robot and then they can actually build on top of it a lot of stuff with like Lego bricks. And
you have bricks with different functionality, like a camera brick.
Yes, exactly.
So
there are different colors, and each color stands for a certain function. So, for example, like red brick, it's ultrasonic sensor. Then we have blue ones, which are motors. Orange one is microcontroller, and it has also microphone and speakers. Then the one with batteries, with Bluetooth module, infrared sensor. Then we actually have, because we have three different sets, and the bigger ones have also accelerometer, LED display, temperature sensor, weather sensor, and even digital camera.
And you have shown in your video that you have created an app so that you can a visual programming for children, these robots that you build with them without a line of code.
Yes. So, our programming interface, it's visual, and it even, like, it's basically symbols which stand for actions. This is like the very first level. Then, like kids which can become more like confident with coding, they can start doing it in Scratch. So we'll also integrate Scratch with our robot. And then we are actually thinking of giving a possibility to program robot in Python. Yeah, that's our, like, yeah, that's something we're going to work
on.
This
is not done yet. This is
it's not yet. So now we are on Kickstarter, and we have, like, our next stretch goal is, so we raised so far 190,000, and our next stretch goal is 300, fingers crossed. So with $300, we want to make an open library of 3D printed accessories for robot.
So
that people can upload their designs or download someone's designs, make something with with it printed at home and 3D printer and use it with a robot.
Can you sell the robot bricks as a set, or can I specifically buy two camera modules or something?
Yeah, so on Kickstarter we sell them as three sets, but of course later on we will be selling additional modules.
Do you know already about your license? Have you an open hardware license or open software license for your
scope? So Scratch is open source, and we provide also an API. We'll provide an API for people. The visual programming interface is going to be ours.
Remain closed.
Yes.
And how are design of your bricks themselves, are they patented or?
We patented the connection system. Yes, but like with the, we believe that with this 3D printed accessories, which will be like all open, people will be able to build on top of it.
3D print my own robots.
People like who can do that, they would be able to build something, but it won't be, in order for us to make it easy for people to do that, it's gonna be quite a lot of effort because we're putting electronics inside the cubes and everything is quite sophisticated.
Do you have an official cooperation with Lego? Because you say you're a Lego competitor.
No, we don't. Like, it's what is actually cool. Lego patents expired, so now everybody can use this kind of. So we are not like allowed to say we copy Lego. We're just like we are Lego compatible, and that's what we are doing.
What was the inspiration of doing your thing in cooperation with the existing systems like the Lego Mindstorm robot? There are several robot kits out there.
So. We looked at them and like what we wanted to do, we wanted to create a robot for younger kids. Because Lego Mindstorms is a really cool robot, but it's not an easy entry. Like the kids can't just start playing with it. Like they need either a lot of guidance or they need something before. And we wanted a robot which even like a 5-year child could start playing with.
5-year-old
to start in with. Yeah. But of course like it's because of Scratch and Scratch is more exciting and then because we have like three different sets which are also like have a lot of functions, we notice that even parents buy it sometimes for themselves because it just it's if you have like digital camera in a robot, like you can come up with quite a lot of what you could do with that.
Did you experience how kids or school kids interact with the robots? Did you make some test run with
your
in schools? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so we had already three different designs and like we changed them because we were like testing them with kids and like seeing what works best. The design we have now we believe is really good. Also we continue testing the integration of app with robot because it's also something super important because of course building it's very important part of the kids build a robot and then they program a robot they build themselves. Mm-hmm. So they see how this robot comes to life with coding. Building has to be very intuitive, but then coding is also a very important part, and this is what we are continuously doing.
And have you experienced how the kids interact with the robots? So they like them from first time, or they need a teacher to explain them that this is a robot?
It depends on children because there are some children which are very comfortable with technology and there are some which need a bit of help. But our robot is also very colorful, so it's something kids are kind of also maybe it's a bit of Lego association, these colorful bricks, what you should do with them, you snap them together. but it's funny sometimes you have to explain them to give them some guidance that if you want wheels to be driving, they have to be parallel and not in some funny combination, but it's also kind of experimentation, which is a good learning effect for kids to which combinations of robots are viable and which are just for fun.
Do you know where the bricks will be produced?
They're produced in China. So last year we were part of Hardware Accelerator Hacks, and we spent almost half a year in Shenzhen, China, working on organizing manufacturing.
To support you, you would love that people go to your Kickstarter page.
Exactly.
What
so
is the best web page to visit your project?
So go to startrobo.com or just Google Robo Wunderkind on Kickstarter.
Wunderkind is a German name.
Yeah. So we.
That, Isn't that hurting your global marketing?
Not really. Like, it's been recognized also in the English-speaking realm, area, English-speaking countries. And, like, we liked Wunderkind because it's a combination of, like, Wunderkind and genius, and we believe that every child is a genius. And also, it's like a wonder kid, like a small wonder. So we just liked it, a combination of a genius and a small wonder, which is in every child. And we believe that, like, if we introduce kids at an early age technology, we give them a lot of possibilities and open and totally new world, and they could do some amazing things with it.
Can you shortly speak how you met the other guys of the project? So I was leaving, the guys came to study.
To Vienna. I was already done with my studies, and like we basically all met at Pioneers Festival, which is like a huge startup event in Vienna. Yeah. And yeah, it's funny that like we're a very international team, but we all met in Vienna. So now that's the place where we are based. Okay. Our home base.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.